Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock on a Saturday, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And today I've got somebody on the channel and I have been trying to get them on for a long time, but they've been incredibly busy. They've been incredibly busy performing at a very high level, creating some of the most innovative tricks that have been released to the magic community. They've been busy fooling Penn and Teller. This person is an absolute legend in the magic community and somebody whose name just gets bigger and bigger and bigger every single week as a creator, as an innovator, as a performer, as just an all-round nice guy. I am, of course, talking about the one and only John Morton. How you doing, man?
That's a hell of an intro. Wow, true. That is one hell of an intro. I don't know that I can live up to that. I thought you were going to say somebody else's name at the end of that because I'm thinking, who's this guy? Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm gonna note all that down and have that somewhere on a poster, I think, because that's great.
Mate, it's all true. It's all true. Like, I'm a magic reviewer, so I see a lot. And everybody, I've just come back from the session. So many people are talking about you and the stuff that you do. And, you know, the stuff that you've done on Penn and Teller, you'll see the FU trophy behind you. And yeah. And it's like, and I want to talk about all of this. We will get into all of this, but you've done so much in the magic community. And there's some creators out there that kind of, they create the magic, but you never see them perform. You never see them actually walking the walk. You only see them talking the talk. But you're out there performing and showing that you've got the chops and proving that everything that you actually bring out is stuff that can be worked. And, you know, in an industry where there's more and more pipe dreams that are coming out every single day, we need more people like you in magic. So I'm so glad that A, you're around, and B, you found time to come on the channel. So thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you. No, it's been great. And what you're doing to this channel is amazing. The fact that all these people, I listen to the podcast all the time. In fact, this will be the only one I never listen to because I hate looking at myself or watching myself. It took me about 3 months to watch the Penn and Teller thing. I just couldn't do it. And I still haven't watched the lecture I did at the Magic Circle. Just not going to happen.
You're one of the very few people that haven't. Everyone else has. And it was an amazing lecture. For anybody who's been living under a rock forever and doesn't know who you are or isn't really aware of what you've accomplished, let's spend a few minutes just talking about who you are and what you've done and why I'm so excited to get you in the channel. We'll start off at the very beginning and we'll go for the origin story. Tell me, John, how you got into magic. Where did it all start?
Well, it's a bit of the cliche thing, unfortunately. I'm afraid there's nothing really interesting for it. I was 7. I'm at the age when Paul Daniels was king on TV. I was just a little bit too young for David Nixon, but Paul Daniels was at his height. I even had a Paul Daniels scrapbook where I used to cut out everything about Paul Daniels. I wish I still had it, actually. But that's how sad I was. But I had everything about Paul Daniels in this thing. I was completely obsessed with him and his show and everybody that was on the show. I remember seeing Jeff McBride do his mask act on there and, oh my God, everything just blew me away. So that's really what got me into magic. And then from there, I used to like, my dad actually made a magic box for me that used to have all my tricks in it. Again, lots of Paul Daniels tricks. I also invented one or two of my own at that point as well. I was trying to think of stuff. We never had a lot of money when I was little. So I used to make a lot of my own toys. And I guess the creative side that I'm doing now is just continued on for that, really. And then I used to do little shows in the back garden to my friends and things, you know. And then you sort of grow up a little bit, and then I discover girls and Star Wars was on, and I sort of went away from magic a little bit. And then I would say, oh God, quite a while then, between there, obviously I'd grown up, left school. I worked in a jewelry shop, which is my trade is a jeweler. Then I went from jewelry. I ran a theme park for 2 years, all the retail and catering side of a theme park, and one or two of the rides as well, with over 100 staff under me. That was fun. Then I went into clothing, selling suits. Well, again, which is it's funny because the wedding industry has kind of been in the background for most of my career. So I have jewelry, wedding rings, engagement rings, then suits. It was like lots of suits for people getting married and things. And then I jumped from that back into jewelry again, and I ran a jewelry shop for a couple of years. In fact, you asked me about 7 years. And then during that time, I'd got married and divorced and the theme park and everything. And then I met Colleen, who's my current wife. A lot of people, if they've met me at conventions, will have met Colleen as well, because she's often on the stand with me. She dems tricks the same as me. And she discovered on a wall of a supermarket somewhere a poster advertising our local magic circle. So I was like, oh, that was good. It's funny because three things happened at once. She found that poster with the circle. David Blaine came on the scene doing his first special, which blew me away and instantly got me back into magic. And I discovered there was a magic shop local to me, which isn't there anymore, sadly, and the circle's gone as well. But those three things happened literally within the space of about 3 weeks. So it was almost like somebody was telling me I need to go back into magic. And so I bit the bullet, and there was a meeting that night. So we literally rang up a guy called Gary Bryson, who became a magical mentor for me. Myself and Tom Wright, actually, both learned under Gary. Gary was there, he invited me in. I came along, and I was lucky, the lecture that night was Etienne Pradier. You know, which blew me away, because Etienne did all his work in set. So what a start, you know. It blew me away. So that was my first jump back into magic.
And how old were you there? How old were you at this point when you came back into magic?
So I'm probably getting back into magic. Let me think. Probably about 33, 34, somewhere around there.
So all of the time during the jewelers and the clothing and the theme park and everything, you'd really stopped completely. You just did it as a kid.
Pretty much, yeah. It was a hobby. I dabbled, but it was only very slightly, yeah. During the jewellery trade, funny enough, because I was still in the jewellery trade when all this happened, I did actually start making a few tricks, and I did a few tricks in the shop. So the reason for that is when you're in a jewellery shop, you have loads and loads of glass counters, right? And the kids come in and go, bum, 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 and you have fingerprints everywhere, which you've then got to clean off, which is a pain in the bum. So I figured if I do a few tricks for the kids, it does two things. A, the parents stay longer and therefore buy something good for sales. And B, I don't have to clean all the counters because the kids are only with me. So I used to do a lot of tricks while I was in the jewelry shop. I invented a trick while I was in there, actually, on the repair counter, where I could take broken pieces of gold chain. I dropped them into a test tube, put a cork on it, shook it up, and then you tip the gold chain out, and now it was repaired. So that was, you know, things like that really worked well in the shop. I used to do a lot of bill switch where I'd change the tillery seat into a tenner or something. You know, the kids loved all that as well.
Can imagine, yeah.
So that was pretty much what happened, really, and that's what got me back into magic. And then it sort of progressed with that as a hobbyist. I became the president. I've done the secretary job. I've done the treasurer job. All this particular magic circle at the time, North Links it was. And I really respect and thank, I don't think people realise just what a thankless job them jobs are for a magic club, because nobody realised just how much work goes into it to get it all running. And nobody appreciates, you know, you're up late trying to get a hold of a lecturer or you're doing all the paperwork for it and go collecting the subs in and all the stuff. Nobody realizes that with a magic club a lot of the time. So if you're in a magic club, shake the hand of the guy that's organizing it and the other part of it, because there's a lot to it. So I did that for a while. And then Tom Wright had started, and we obviously, I know you know Tom. Everybody knows Tom for his thread work. Well, Tom had started gigging. He'd been working for quite a while at that point. I think he'd been doing sort of like 3 or 4 years. And he double booked himself for a wedding. purely by mistake. So he says to me, you know magic, you can fill in for me. So all of a sudden I got a first gig thrown into it.
Okay.
And
right,
I was like,
okay.
Right, okay. So I remember where it was and everything. And I ended up, I think I did 3 hours for about £100, something like that. And when I think about the act, actually, there's still one or two pieces that are still in my act, but there was a lot of it that was that would never go in my act now. But I remember leaving that thinking, wow, that was really good fun. And I wouldn't mind doing a few more of them. So I started sort of doing the odd gig here and there, and it built up and built up. And I decided that maybe this is something I want to follow on and actually do for a living. Because the jewelry and the clothing industry, retail in general, to be honest, is sort of on its way down. I mean, even more so now after the pandemic with the internet, but this is sort of like pre-internet, which is the internet was starting to build. But the customer service bit really was starting to go. People weren't interested in customer service anymore. You weren't supposed to approach anybody anymore. It was just a case of you were till staff, really, which is not my style. I've always been customer service. And when you think about magic and close to magic, that is essentially customer service. You're just talking to people, you know. So I enjoyed that part of it. So started doing more and more gigs. It got to the point where I was probably 50-50 on my time and money, the money was coming in. So I had to make a decision on what I was going to do. So I was running Burton's. The last one I was doing was Burton's, the menswear shop that sadly is no longer around. And I was the manager of that. And I went to my area manager and said, I'm looking at sort of going full-time into this magic eventually. So I was wondering about maybe I could go part-time and go. So I'd do like, I'd have weekends off was the idea, to do weddings or whatever, because mostly weddings is what I was doing. And then work in the week. But she wouldn't let me do it, not as manager. So I had to give up the manager role and all the money that went with it. And I got put down to, I think it was a 20-hour contract. And I had to do that for about 2 years. And it nearly killed me those 2 years. I hated it with a passion. Because the problem with it is you sat on the till, there's nobody else in the shop. And all you're thinking about is magic. And you're just thinking, I could be doing a wedding now and earning the same money I'm going to work for this entire week in 2 hours, you know. So that really hurt. But at the end of the day, I had a mortgage and a wife and a kid to support. Or I didn't have a kid then, but I was, you know, we were on the way for all that. So I had to progress slowly, which is what I did. So I did another 2 years there until the business was really building, and then eventually made the leap and went full time. And that's it. That's very long-winded to say what the origin story is.
So that is a very interesting origin story, and I want to actually expand on that in a minute. But let me ask you a piece of advice. I get asked on this channel all the time, when's the best time to go full-time? When's the best time to go pro? You know, I've been doing this as a hobby. I've done some gigs. I'm a semi-pro. I want to go pro. What do I do? And people anguish over this for a long time. And, you know, sometimes people never do it. And sometimes people jump in too early. As somebody who's been in that situation and had a family that they've had to support, had a mortgage and had a full-time job that they've had to jump into, any advice on that?
Don't do it until your gigs are enough to support you without. So if you can go part-time and do it half and half, that's great. You've got to protect your mortgage, your house, your livelihood. That's the most important thing. Don't think you're going to give up and then all of a sudden the phone's going to start to ring and everyone's going to book you. It ain't going to happen. I've got a magician friend of mine that did that very thing. He gave up his job because he hated it. I went, that's it, I'm a full-time magician now. I'm like, right, okay. I think he lasted a month till the money ran out. And then all of a sudden he started getting looking for another job again. Because you can't do it. So if you're going to step into that, start doing gigs, start getting your diary filled in, start building up the weddings or whatever. I mean, weddings is obviously the easiest one for us here in the UK. In America, maybe not so, although I do think America's on its way. I've got a guy at the moment that I'm helping out with a lot of advice for weddings in America, and he's starting to really kick in now. So there are a few of them over there that are really going to do well. And like the sort of five or six here, the Faye Prestos and the Matt Pauls, people like that, that did it here, the Andy Nymans, all them ones, you know, Anthony Owen and that. Those boys did it here. They guys are going to do it over there. And all of a sudden, the guys in America are going to have a massive industry that's ripe for the picking, basically. I really do believe that.
Yeah,
so,
I agree.
So, yeah, so if you're going to do it, go into getting the gigs, make the money so you can afford to live on your gigs. I mean, it'll be horrible. You'll hate it because you'll get to a point where this job's clashing with that job. And you're just like, I'm having to work twice as hard. I'm doing two full-time jobs, essentially, or at least it feels that way. I'm desperately trying to market myself. I'm trying to get as many gigs as I can. I'm working as much as I can doing that. That brings in loads of money for a very small amount of time, and it makes as much money as what I'm doing full-time in the regular job. When it gets to that point, then you have to make the decision. But the decision you have to make is, do I go part-time, do I go full-time? Definitely go part-time, so you've still got the backup of the full-time job. Of the part-time job, just in case. And when you do make the leap, bear in mind you're going to lose that extra wage. Because the problem with it is, when you do that and you build up both the businesses, you've got this regular job that somebody's paying you, and they're doing your sick pay and everything, and then you've got this job that's like self-employed. Yeah, it might be bringing a lot of money in for a short space of time, but it's not 100% regular unless you're working it. If you're not careful, You get used to that kind of money. It's double money, isn't it? Yeah. And when you go just for that job, all of a sudden that money, it's not there anymore. So now this job, whereas before you're on like, I don't know, let's say you're on 30 grand. When that drops off, you might only be on 20 grand or 15 grand. So you're going to take a hit. And that's scary because you get very used to that extra money. Very, very used to that extra money. You start going on holidays with it and you start buying luxury things. You buy expensive watches and whatever, because it's just free money when you gig in. But when it's all of a sudden that's the money that has to pay the bills, it's not free money anymore. So really think about it. Make sure you build it up. Make sure that's what you want to do, because it's not right for everybody. Some people are better to do just a part-time job. We're in a full-time job and have it as extra money and just enjoy it as extra money.
Yeah.
You know, it's full-time's a funny thing. I mean, I've survived for the last, 15, 16 years, I think it is, on just magic. Well, no, magic and part-time. And then for the last, I think, 11 years, it might be full-time I've done, where that's it solely. But I don't just survive on that. There's the creative side. My prop building side is building. And I've been doing that for quite a while. So one tops up the other one when it's, you know, when the money's not there, or when the pandemic hits and you don't have any work for 2 years, you know.
And that's important, having other income streams.
Massively.
So you're not just relying purely on, because if a pandemic does hit, well, it happened, didn't it? I mean, it happened, you know, the amount of magicians who just before the pandemic were considered some of the biggest names in the industry in terms of fees and in terms of bookings. And they were like, oh, we're riding high. Everything's fantastic. They were the first people to get a delivery job with Amazon when the crap hit the wall. And I think it's because, you know, like you said, you had other income streams coming in. It wasn't just from magic. It's from creating the props and this and that and the other. And, you know, a lot of magicians don't have that. And I think it's really important to kind of try and diversify in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, when the pandemic hit, I didn't sit down and just do nothing. The first thing I did is I expanded my escape room. So I have a mobile escape room that goes to people's houses and goes to events. So the first thing I did, I expanded that from it doing like four people. It now does 16 to 20 people at once. So it's an event as opposed to a thing. We do that in our tea room, which we can talk about later if you like, that we've got in the village. So I expanded that, and then I started looking at the other tricks I could make. And then coupled with Luca Volpe, who's a good friend of mine, I know you know Luca, we brought out Icon ESP. And working on the basis of that, that was enough to then keep me afloat, along with the grant that we got from the government. I was lucky enough to get a little bit of that. That kept me afloat through the pandemic. So I didn't need to worry. I was a lot better off than most people when it came to certainly most magicians when it came to the pandemic. Because I had the extra revenue stream. You know, I'm a firm believer that if you put your mind to anything, you can earn you can work your way out of any situation when it comes to money. You know, there was always a way. One point I was building, I don't know if I've got one around here. Where is it? I've got that much stuff in this workshop. I can't find it now. I built some fancy vintage mobile phone stands for the iPhones. Mm-hmm. And I built one for myself, happened to put it on Facebook, and all of a sudden I had loads of people wanting them. So at one point I was knocking them out as well during the pandemic. You know, things like that. I make all kinds of bits and bobs. This, give you an idea. Everyone probably thought that was a virtual background for a second then. this, which is it's actually a trick, but it's like a pensive thing from Harry Potter, and it's got the little bottles in it, and you can store things in it, like the baby's first tooth, things like that. So I built things like that, which were selling, you know. So you can build your way out of anything, or you just got to think, what can I do to earn the money, you know? So have an extra revenue stream, definitely, definitely. Don't just think full-time's going to be enough until you're really well established.
Yeah, 100%. That's incredible advice. So going back to your story, so you've gone full-time. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we know from what we've just talked about, things have been getting better and better and better for you every year. When did you decide, you've talked about making little things when you're working in the shop and everything, but when did you actually start thinking, you know what? I want to start creating magic. I want to be a creator. Because I was speaking to Lloyd Barnes about this actually earlier on. And he was making the point that most people in magic, they're either performers or they're creators. There is a little bit of a crossover. You look at the Greg Wilsons of the world and, you know, the people like that that do both. But a lot of the time, the creators, Lloyd is a perfect example. Lloyd is not a performer. He's never done a gig in his life, but he's created some absolutely amazing tricks. You are a performer, but you're also a creator, which is very unusual, really. So how did that come about? What made you go, you know what, I've got this full-time income coming in from magic, and that's great, but now I want to diversify and I want to be a creator. Was it a desire to have a second income stream, or was it another reason? Was it wanting to share magic with the community? Where did that all come from?
I think it was wanting to share magic, to be honest. I mean, I've created a fair few things that I've just given away over the years to people. So it's my way of giving back, I suppose, in some ways. It's just being nice, you know. Don't get me wrong. There was a time we were over in Blackpool, myself and my wife, and we went to JV Magic. And it was in the days when they used to have the magazine. Remember the magazine with the spring binder? Oh, my God, I love that magazine so much. I must have read it inside out. I probably still got one somewhere knocking around in the cupboard here. And I remember we went into their shop, and I can't think what I bought. I think I bought a Raven and something else. I can't remember at them days. It was what was in at the time. And I remember saying to my wife, one day I'll have one of my tricks will be on that shelf. But it wasn't a case of, I'm going to go out there just to create something because I want to be magic famous. That was never the goal. And it still isn't the goal. It's more a case of it's happened.
It's happened.
Yeah, but it's happened slowly. I mean, I was very underground. I've been creating tricks now since, I think it's 2009, something like that. And for a long time, certain people knew about me, and they would come to me and I would build stuff for them, or I'd have a trick and I would give it to them, or I'd sell it to them, whichever. Most of the time I'd give it to them because I'm like that. My wife goes mad at me because I give too much away. But so I was doing that for quite a while beforehand. So I suppose the creativity side, again, it goes back to being that kid of just can't afford it, so I'll build it myself kind of thing. So I think that the time I became very, very creative was the moment I stopped looking about what everybody else does. So I made a conscious effort of stopped watching the review shows. I didn't look online at all the latest tricks. I just stopped. And even now, I catch your review show sometimes. Usually when it pops up, I'll watch it. I'll watch the Wizard product review sometimes nowadays when it pops up, again, if it pops up. But most of the time, I don't learn about a new trick unless one of my mates tells me, you've got to see this, it's amazing. So then I'll go see it. That way, the reason for that is because what I found is when you look at what everybody else is doing, you can't help yourself but try and create the same thing. So you just become them. You put yourself in their mindset. That's why at one point all the same tricks come out together, because they're all sparked by the same thing, and then they all build on it, and all of a sudden they all come out, because the time zone it takes to build something, they all come out around the same time. So I guess the creative side for me was that, and it's also a case most time it's just a case I've built it for myself because I want to work something, and then somebody's gone, that's amazing. And eventually I'll go, right, okay, I'm ready to give it up now. And then I'll make it for other people. Or I'll do something. My wife goes mad at me again for this thing. I'll make something, I'm really proud of the way it looks. I'll put a picture of it on Facebook, and then I'll get 100 people messaging me going, we want one. So I did that for quite a while. But it was never a conscious effort as such to be a creator, I guess. It's just a case of, if there's a need for it, then I'll make, like the egg thing's a prime example, the Transform 8. It just serves a purpose. It's even if I don't perform it, somebody out there is probably going, I really would like to do Silk Twig, and I would like to do it walk around at the table, so I'm doing it in front of everybody, but a good group. But I daren't walk, because if I have a raw egg and somebody bumps into me when they're walking past, oh my God, my pocket's going to be a mess. Well, yeah. So that pool ball idea of it being a pool ball solves that issue for them. You know, so if you want to do that trick, it solves a problem. Likewise, the tricks I've brought out, the twins, for example, the twins is a way to do that trick. The impromptu is the gold on that routine. And I know you've got it, so you know the impromptu version of it.
It's incredible.
And so for me, again, that serves a purpose, so that you don't have to carry loads of stuff when you go out. You can just go out with nothing if you want on you, and somebody says, sure, as a drink, you can still do it.
Yeah.
You know, it just serves a purpose.
Yeah, it does, yeah. 100%. I completely agree with you. And twins, I mean, myself and Rylan reviewed it. It's an incredible trick. It is one of my favourite impromptu tricks to do. Rylan now does it with Lego. He just had, because to Rylan, Lego is impromptu. He's always got his pocket stuffed with Lego. So, you know, it's great. And it's a perfect example of what I mean when I said that when you create a trick, it's designed for a working magician, because you've thought it through to the nth degree. It's not a pipe dream that can only be done from one camera angle, standing on one leg, if your head is tilted slightly to the side. It's not like that. It's like you can do it anywhere. And the other thing is, and we'll come back to you getting into creating in a minute, but one thing that you and I talked about off camera, and it's very interesting that this has happened, and I'd like to know if it's by design or not, you are getting a reputation for yourself now for the style of magic that you do. It's kind of like self-working, guaranteed to work, no skill required. You can literally pick it up and you can do it immediately. You can focus on presentation because there's no moving parts that are going to go wrong. And it's got a very clever method. And people come up to me all the time and they say, oh, this is clever. That's the first thing people say when they talk about your material. Oh, it's so clever. When you did the circle lecture, everyone was like, oh, it's so clever. It's all so clever. And it's so easy. Was that by design? Because there's very few magicians that get pigeonholed like that as creators. You know, you do get a few, but very rarely. But you have almost like a specific niche that you create into. And if that was by design, does that limit you? Like, do you come up with a routine sometimes and it's like, well, this is going to require a pass. Damn, I can't market this because it doesn't fit with what I do. But I'd love to know about that.
Yeah, I suppose, well, part of it is my own limitations, to be honest. if anybody sees me with cards, I've got a friend of mine who's a really good card magician, Steve, and he laughs at my double lift, although it's never been picked up by anybody else, but he's like a perfectionist. So for him, it's like terrible, I guess. I don't think it's that bad. It's never been, I've never lost anybody with it, but, you know, he thinks I should do it a different way. It's not the claw or anything. I do just a turnover, but... yeah, he still doesn't think it's very good. So, and the thing is with me is so my memory's not that good. As I've got older, my memory's getting worse. My eyesight's shot. So these are very focused. I hate getting old. So it has to be something. If I'm gonna, if there's something small I need to see, I need to see it for a while. It's not going to be a quick glimpse, unless it's big. So that's the limitation for me straight away. So memory work's completely out the window. I've actually got something that might be coming out that's got a little bit of memory work. But if it has got memory work, it wants to be dead simple to learn memory work. If it's, it doesn't have to be knuckle busting. There's no knuckle busting things. I'll tell you one of the big things with it, no process. I really hate tricks where there's tons and tons of process. You know, I want you to think of a number. Now add six. Now add your eye color retina and think about a date and a million things. And then, oh, yeah, it's this. It's like, really? That was a lot of work for that. I hate tricks like that with a passion. It should be, if you're a mind reader, somebody go, what am I thinking of? You go, you're thinking of that. But ideally, that's the perfect scenario. I mean, yes, it's boring. There's no theater to it. But in theory, that's what it should be. So if you're doing, when it comes to tricks, I can't stand things with loads and loads of process like that. So that's another limitation I put on myself. It has to be simple. I want it to be easy. So you can literally teach. I mean, I've got a little 8-year-old, Eleanor. Eleanor can do everything that I brought out easily. And she's 8. And she's not even into magic, but she could do it. And it's not because I've spent hours and hours teaching her. It's because she's seen me do it, you know, around the house, and she's seen me working it and getting practiced on it. And, you know, so I know I'm slick with it. All my tricks are not about, the method's really simple. There's no memory work. There's no particular skill. Most of it's self-working. But what you do have to work on is the presentation. And I'm purposely, while I give a presentation, and most of my stuff has a video of me at least performing it, I think they all do, pretty much, apart from Icon, weirdly enough. There is some footage out there of somebody else doing it. But I can say, I do send people what I perform and the way I perform it, if somebody's interested. But I want them to be themselves. We were talking about it earlier. You know, when Michael Armagh first came out on his Michael Armagh videos, everyone goes, starts going around going, hi, I'm Michael Armagh, let me talk like this. And they put an American accent on when they're performing. It's like, what are you doing? And you do it because you've watched it a million times over and over again to get the moves and everything. But before you know it, you become that person. And I don't want anybody to become me. There's no point in becoming me. That's not going to win anything. You want to be you when you're performing. So as long as people take the trick and then put their own spin on it and their own presentation on it, then I'm really happy, you know. And yes, it does limit me because I can't do something that's going to be seen to be massively out of sort of the skill level of a lot of people. I don't want that. I want my work to be just as suitable for a hobbyist and somebody that's just getting into magic, but still be level enough for a pro to work it at a gig. That's the limitations I'm setting myself. So it is hard sometimes. And again, reliable, 100%, can't go wrong. There's no buzzy magic, so there's nothing that can go wrong that way. It has to all be working stuff and reliable, yeah. Hope that answered the question on that.
Yeah, it does. It does. And so from a creative point of view, because you have become known as one of the top creators in the magic community right now, what, I suppose there's a lot of people that watch this channel that want to be creators. And we do, don't we? I've talked about this on my channel before. When you come into magic, when you're new into magic, we put creators up on a pedestal. And it's like, oh, if you want to be revered in this community, you have to come up with your own trick. So very quickly, when people come into magic, it's like, right, okay, I'm going to create my own trick now. And there's a lot of, I don't know, shit going out in the magic community, half-baked, half-thought-out ideas that haven't been worked in. And as I said, you totally do not embody that. But for anybody that's wanting to make a name for themselves as a creator, for whatever reason, maybe they listen to you and they want to diversify and get another income stream coming in over time. Maybe they've got the same desire as you of wanting to give back to the community, whatever the reason. Is there any advice on creativity? And most specifically, from speaking to people on this channel, the thing that I think most people struggle with is inspiration. You know, coming up with the initial idea. Any advice on the creative process? And I know this could be a 5-hour interview in its own right, but if, you know, if there's any little nuggets that you could drop, that would be amazing.
Funny enough, I listened to your podcast with Lloyd the other week. Lloyd went really in depth about his creative process. And it was probably one of the best things I've ever heard on a podcast ever. And I related to a lot of what he said, because my this workshop's again got lots of little things that I bought because gone that can be a trick or that's something or I'm going to play with that. I've got a thing up here. Where is it? Let me think. I'm trying to think where it is. I've got a box somewhere up here. So you know the psychic touch thing, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can you're sat on a chair and it touches you or whatever. Yeah. I don't want to go into too much methods. But have you ever heard of a thing called Switchbot?
No.
So what Switchbot is there's a little black box. It's this big. I've got it somewhere knocking around here. And it goes to your phone and you press a button and it pushes a button. So it can flick the switch on or it can push a button on your kettle or it can. And there's lots of little arms that come with this thing. And it's this big and it works on your phone. And you can have a million of them clicked up in your house, all switching different things on.
Wow.
I think PK touches. I think putting that into a chair and you've got something there that costs you £25. Yeah. So I look at things like that. I see something and I never think of it for what it's used for. It's like the prime example of that would be the thing I showed on the Magic Circle lecture recently about the vegetable bags in Morrison's. If you go into, and I don't mind sharing this on the podcast, but if you go into, well, any of the supermarkets at the moment, they're selling reusable net bags for your vegetables, you know, for loose vegetables, you know, carrots and stuff. And I was walking, I was happened to be buying a salad in Morrison's, I walked past that, saw it, and I thought, wow. So I bought two and put one inside the other. And hey, presto, you've got a force bag. So, and they're only 40 pence each. So for 80p, you've got essentially a net clear force bag with a drawstring on it. It takes very minimal sewing. Literally, you're sewing three sides up. And you've got something that's professional quality, really mega strong because it's designed to hold like potatoes and stuff at the end of the day. So it's going to last you a lifetime for 40 pence. So just by walking around things like that, I see things and I never look at them for what they can be, what they're actually used for. I look at things that, you know, for what they could be. B&Q and a stationery shop are probably my favorite magic shops. Because I could just walk around B&Q and make a million tricks out of B&Q. I really could, you know. Lock me in a B&Q for a week and I'll give you a year's worth of tricks. Because just by walking around that place, you get inspired about what you could do. You know, as long as you don't think of things as what they are, you know, look at things in a different way and you've got something. It's like, here's one for you, disposable razors, okay? You know the little, you know, you get a little cartridge sometimes that you have like disposable razor things and you click it in and, yeah? You know what I'm on about?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever noticed that those, if you take the disposable razors out, you've got like a three little shelf thing. They make a great index system if you stick two together because they fit a Mercury card perfectly in that slot. So if ever you've got one to three way out or a four way out in your pocket index, just stick two of them together and you've got them. You've got it. And it costs you nothing. It's, you know, you got some razors out of it. And it, all it is, it just locks together. So when you look at these things, I always walk around and see things like that. And I think that could be used for something else. So I guess that's where the creativity side. If you want to know how to, or my process when it comes to actually how I think around a problem, if you like, because I like the problem solver part of it. I've always been problem solving as a manager throughout the retail career. Everything's always a problem solved. The best advice I can give to if you want to come up with a trick, imagine seeing somebody perform it on Britain's Got Talent, then work out how they did it, and then rip them off. Because you're not actually ripping them off, because it's only a person in your head. Remember, you know, think how many times we've all been around a magic convention and you stand there on the side and the guy's demoing a trick and you go, okay, and you look at it and you go, well, he's either that way, or that way. It's one of those four or five different methods. And whether you buy it or not, you can't help yourself as a magician when you've been in the business long enough. You see the methods, and it's going to be one of those four or five. So imagine doing that. If you want to come up with a method to do something, imagine seeing that person at that magic convention. Do the exact trick, literally pitch them in your mind of them actually doing the trick you want to create. Then work out the four or five different ways they did it, this imaginary magician, then rip him off with the best one. Nobody can tell you off, because at the end of the day, he's only in your head, he's imaginary. But it's a really good way to visualize how you could do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So that's how it, so I have a lot of magicians come to me with a problem where I want to achieve this. How can I do it? So that's exactly what I do. I imagine watching somebody do it and then working out how this imaginary person did it, write all the methods down, and then come out with the one that actually works.
That's
easiest
brilliant.
Way.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. I mean, that's incredible advice. And in terms of releasing the magic, so you've got to a point where you've created the trick and you want to release it. You've been quite interesting. I think the first time I ever saw you bring anything out, it was Icon.
Yeah.
And I remember you were affiliated at the beginning with World Magic Shop, I think, or at least I remember seeing you on the World Magic Shop stand. I know it's your own thing, but I remember seeing you on the World Magic Shop stand. And you mentioned the eight ball routine, which is the tilt to egg with the eight ball, which is brilliant. That obviously came out through Saturn. Then I know you're working with various other production companies as well. And I also know that you bring stuff out yourself as like maybe a one-off piece or a limited release through your own company. Excuse me, you had your own dealer stand at Blackpool, for example. So when you get to a point where you've got this trick to be released, what do you do? Do you go to a production company? Do you bring it out yourself? Which company do you go for? How do you get that person interest or that company interested in saying, yes, I want that product? And how do you make sure that people buy it and it becomes successful so that other people want to buy more in the future?
Okay, so let's write that down. Right, so the first, I nearly always create something for myself. So the idea is that if I come up with something, it's never to release it as a product. It's always because I want it. I want to do it, basically. The first thought when I make something is I'll always make prototype. I'll make something that works for me. And I'll work it, basically. Then if I get people asking me about it and if I'm ready to give it, sort of give it away, give my baby out, basically, to the community, then first thought is I'm going to self-release it. That's always my first thought. Having said that, if it's your first product, it's handy to have a name out there. So Icon did that for me. Icon wasn't actually the first trick I ever released. I self-released the trick originally. The very first one I ever released was a trick called Apparition. And what Apparition was, it was a trick where I might re-release it at some point, but I would want to improve the handling a little bit. But the trick was somebody chose a card. The card went into the middle of the deck. You could see it physically go into the middle of the deck. You took all the cards, you put them into a tracing paper bag, I guess, so you could see through it. You wrapped the deck up so it was sealed. You couldn't get to it. Then you took a pencil and literally rubbed across the top of the deck, of the back of the cards, and the card image would appear on the, like a Brass Rubbins type thing. Brass Rubbins was his original name, but we changed it to Apparition because it sounded cooler. But we rubbed it and it would there. And then you could take the cards out and you could have to go through the cards and the card would still be in the middle and the deck was examinable. That was it. So that was the first trick I ever released. And I sold quite a few of them through eBay because I was just selling stuff on eBay at that point. And there was a guy in France, a magician in France that bought it. And then promptly released it as his own trick about a month later. So that was my first step into be careful what you release, I guess. But if you're going to release something out, it is handy to have a name, or at least for people to know a little bit about who you are. It doesn't have to be a massive thing, and you don't really need it, but it does help a little bit, which is where World Magic Store came in. And that came about through Tom Wright and David Penn, basically. Tom showed it to David. David really liked it, wanted it for his own set. So that was why. And I mean, it's massively improved now. The one that I sell now is nothing like the one we did originally with World Magic Store. This one, the new one folds, so it's smaller, because again, that was something that people said at Blackpool, it'd be handier if it was smaller. because a lot of people wanted it for cruise ships. You couldn't knock it because if you did, all the tiles would fall off it. Now the whole board shimmed so that the tiles basically attach themselves like fridge magnets to it. The board's all wood veneered, so it all blends in. Everything was improved a million times over. So I guess the thing with it is you've got two avenues, really, when it comes to releasing magic. If you want to make a decent amount of money, or at least an amount that's worth it for you doing it, then self-release it. You won't sell as many by a long shot. You're never going to sell a million. You're never going to become a name in the magic community. You're just going to be this little guy who makes funny stuff that people like, and it'll sell slow. It's what I call a slow burn trick. If you want to become magic famous, as it were, then sell it to Alakazam or somebody that's reputable. Show it to them. If Peter Nardi knows his stuff, the guy's a genius. You know, he knows it. He knows all the tricks. He knows he's good or bad. Go to Peter, and Pete will go, it's been done before. Or he'll go, yeah, I like that, but could you just tweak it this way, make it a bit better? Or he'll add some input himself, you know, or to yourself, for example. That's why, you know, Penguin are coming to you with the idea of, you know, this is the trick we've got, but we need another million routines to go with it. Could you do us a 5-hour tutorial on that? You know, because again, because your mind works very well on the, now I've got this prop, what else can I do with it? I couldn't do what you do.
I couldn't make an icon. I couldn't make a gimmick like Lloyd does. I'm not wired that way, but you can give me a prop and I can come up with like a million different things for it.
Yeah, which is really handy. You need people like that. Tom Wright's very much the same, you know. Tom, I mean, I hope you won't mind me saying this, I'm sure he won't. Tom, as a creator, he can't build that much to save his life. But he's extremely good, I mean, like proper world class, at taking something and mixing it up with a load of other things, and all of a sudden it's this amazing thing. If ever you've seen him perform, he can take a bog standard trick that's off the shelf and you won't recognize it by the time he's finished with it, and it'll be the best routine you've ever seen in your life. And so we all have our different strengths, you know. So I might come up with something that might be a cool little gimmick, but I might be crap at performing with it. But Tom might go and go, oh, my, you can do this with it. So it's important to have friends that you can talk to, that you trust, that aren't going to rip you off, that will help you develop the thing. So it's not just one person. Sometimes it's more than others. The baby book, for example, the baby book original method is Stephen Young's. It's not mine. I met Stephen at a convention, a Cyprus convention, and he was doing it with cards, and the method he was using at the time was, I would never have got it in a million years because it was just too hard for speed. I wouldn't have got it.
Yeah.
And then he brought out Visionary 2, which is essentially what the baby book's based on, which is genius. And I said to him, don't make it cards, make it into a book. But he wasn't interested in that. He wanted to make it into cards because that's what he does. He's really good at that. So he said, no, you want to do something with it with a book, you do it with a book, which is where the baby book came about. But again, I looked at it and thought, well, it can't just be a book with random symbols in, because it makes no sense. Why would you have a book with random symbols in? It has to be something, which is why it became a book for kids, because obviously I had a one-year-old at the time. She was just coming to one. So I genuinely did make it for Eleanor, and she genuinely used it as a kid's book. I've got the original baby book here. So just to show, this is one. This is like from, she's 8 now, so this is 7 years old, this book. It's still got her teeth marks in the top of it from when she was 1. All right, she chewed it to death. It's wrecked. It's completely wrecked. It doesn't leave the house anymore. And there's the thing with Penn & Teller. Look, that's the Penn & Teller one, different cat. That's because of the copyright issues in America. They're scared to death of being sued. Even though they're all royalty-free images, I had to remake the book from scratch. If you're going to build a thing, make it have a reason, because it needs to have a reason. So it's logical for what it is. And if you're going to release it, if you want to just get your name out there, fine, sell it to a magic shop. You won't make much money on it, because you can't make much money on things like that. They'll pay you a fee for the royalties of it, for the rights of it, and then they earn the money on it, not you. But then the good thing with that is then you can move on to the next thing. So, which is handy. If you're like, your life, for example, is insanely busy, there's no way in a million years you're going to spend hours in a workshop building a load of things. When I first released Icon ESP, those things take me about 3 or 4 days to make if I concentrate on it. When we first released it, we got 4 months worth of work in a night. So I spent pretty much half my pandemic working 12 hours a day trying to fill all the orders that we'd got. So it went from being very bored to being insanely busy, and it hasn't really stopped from there. If the item's something that you're having to make and it takes you plenty of time and it's not something, but it is something you've got the ability to make and you want to make the most money of it, self-release it. If it's something that's hard for you to make, give it away, sell it, sell the rights. So for the eight ball trick, I had no interest in particularly sat here making them up. Saturn could do it a million times better than me, so I just let them do it because that's what they're good at. Likewise, here's a prime example. The little envelopes that you get for the Nestor Wallets by Nick Einhorn. Well, I made those. I created those. So originally, I couldn't get to grips with the little hanky. Yeah. I couldn't get to grips with the little handkerchief for it. So I made an envelope for it. And I worked it for ages. It was great. And then I put a picture of them on Facebook. And word got round. And all of a sudden, I was making 500 a week of these little envelopes. And I killed the machine, literally dead. I was making that many of them. It just destroyed it. It took over our lives. Me and my wife, every night, we sat there making these little envelopes. And we're like, there's got to be an easier way. So in the end, Peter approached me, Peter Nardi, and I said, okay, let's sell the rights. It's time to give it away because I can't keep up with demand. It just wasn't happening. So Peter took it. And now they sell them as... deluxe envelopes by Alakazam or something is what they sold now. It's quite funny. They were on Penguin Magic for ages, but they didn't have my name on it. There's only Alakazam that's actually got my name on them. But that was a pretty sat there, you know. Going back to the creativity side, here's another one that a lot of people don't know about. The Smash and Stab by Wayne Dobson. You know, the mini one?
Yeah, with the little circles around the base, yeah.
Yeah, well, that was originally mine.
What?
Yeah, so I saw the big version, the big wooden version. Colin Rose had it on his stand. Absolutely loved it. But I'm a close-up worker, so I don't want to carry these big bloody things around with me. So I wanted something small. And I saw the sauce cups in McDonald's, you know, the little things you put the sauce in. And I'm thinking they would work great for that. And the original idea was to have sauce cups over there and literally just a drawing pin. And then you'd bang, 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 and hopefully not get a drawing pin in your hand. That was the original plan. Couldn't do it. But when I saw the thing with Colin Rose, I thought I could make that smaller. So, again, I've got them around here somewhere knocking about. Originally, I got some door handles, brass door handles from Wilco's, I think it was. And they were a brass doorknob with, like, and they had a plastic, like, and like a metal brass plate that went against the door. And that round flat plate basically became the base. They had like a rope design around it. And I scored the rope design in certain places, the one with the spike on it, and the other three didn't have the spike on it. And the cups would fit perfectly on them. So the idea was you put these cups on, you can mix it around, and then where it was scored, you banged your hand down on it, basically, and you know, you avoided the spike that way. And Wayne was visiting our magic club at the time. He was doing a lecture there. So I showed him the one I'd made. I said to him, "Oh, you know, this is yours, basically, but it's a miniature version of it." And he was like, "That's brilliant. Can you make 100 up for me? I'll take them straight away." And I was like, "No way in a million years can I make 100 of them." Bear in mind, they're only door knot handle things at this point. You know, they were crap when I think about the way they probably looked. They did the job, but they weren't slick and beautiful like the ones he makes are. And I was like, "You do it. It's your trick. I'm not bothered about anything for it. It's not even mine. I can't sell that as mine. It's your product. It's just I miniaturized it for you." So he went, "Oh, that's really kind of you." So he credits me in the instructions as sort of like where it came from. And he sent me one. I've got one, as a display piece that I keep. But again, that's another example of seeing something. I wanted a smaller version of it. I saw the little sauce cup pots and created that from it, you know. And then obviously Wayne's gone on and sold quite a few. And he made it so they stacked, which was, that was his idea, not mine, to make them so they stacked, so it was more practical for your pocket. It always makes me chuckle when I see them in the conventions, though, when they're going around and I see somebody buy it. I always feel great. That's another one, you see, where it's just a case of, I got nothing for that at all. I had no interest in making any money on it. It, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't my trick. You know, it was his. In the same way with the baby book, when I created the baby book, because the method and the core of it isn't mine, I gave all the artwork and the book and everything he needs to do it to create his own and sell. He can, Stephen Young can sell these, and he does sell a version of it. He changed it slightly actually for himself, but he can sell it because, as far as I'm concerned, it's as much his as mine. And when we finally get together, we're having a picture taken with the trophy, because that trophy, if I could split it down the middle, he'd get the half of it, you know, because that's where it belongs to, you know. That's how it came about.
See, and this is why you've got a reputation for being one of the nicest people in magic.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like I say, I give a lot away. I mean, I know I sent, it was not last year, but the year before, the Christmas baby book, I sent out to a load of people to use on their phones. I think you got one as well.
I used it a few times, man. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, because you said to me, I'll do a review, you can sell a few. And I was like, I'm not interested in selling them. It wasn't for that. I only sold it the second year, purely because I thought it was time. But the first time, I literally just sent it out to friends. It's the same with the Happy Books Bookshop book test. Again, it's completely free. It's a working book test that's free online to all magicians, that I web post personally just for that thing. So all of you have got a book test you can do with nothing on you at all. It's just there, you know, and all the instructions are hidden on the site if you know how to get onto them, you know. So if anybody wants to know how to get onto it and they don't know how to get onto it, shoot me a message and I'll tell you what the secret is, or shoot. You probably know what the method is, Craig. I don't know, but it's all built into the site. So everything's there for you, that's, you know. Right. So yeah, why not? You know, that's just giving back, isn't it? It's being nice. That's what it's all about.
You do. You love this community. You love this community. And I can tell that. And just, you know, just off camera, I want to tell everybody, like, we were talking about Ryland because he's got a couple of big shows coming up, and I was wanting to have you build a prop for him. And you were just saying off camera, well, I've got this thing. No one's ever seen it. You know, he would love this and he would love this. And I'm like, who does that in magic? Who has this idea for this absolutely incredible thing and says, well, you know, I really like this kid. He can, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen, John. You're an anomaly. I can't even say the word. You're, you know, in this community, it's rare. There's generous people and then there's you.
Now, there are others out there. There are others out there that'll do things like that as well. There really are. I think it's funny because I was thinking earlier on what you would say about today. And one of the things that stuck with me for a long time, it was on the Magician's podcast, the one that Richard Young used to do, and it was an Andy Nyman quote. And he said, the best advice you can give to anybody, don't be a knob. You know what? He's 100% right, isn't he? Just be nice. And just by being nice to people, they're nice back to you.
Now, listening to that quote, I realise what I've done wrong most of my career.
You know, well, if Andy Nyman says it, you know it's got to be good.
Yeah,
it's
right.
True, though, isn't it? It really is. You know, it's the other thing I've heard. I think it was the Derren Brown lines. Somebody said, if somebody's an arsehole, when they become famous, they'll just be a bigger arsehole. Mm-hmm. And again, that's true. Again, and that's another thing. You know, if you do have some success with anything, don't think you're the God's gift to everything, because you're not. You've got success then. You've done well. Happy days. Pat yourself on the back. Carry on. Don't get a big head about it. I have a massive imposter syndrome, big time. And the reason for it is because when people, if they're performing, if you perform a trick to a lay person and they've never seen a magician before, they will tell you, you're amazing. You need to go on Britain's Got Talent. You're the best thing ever. Oh, my God, you're like, I don't know, David Blaine. But they're only saying that because they haven't seen the guy next to you who's a million times better than you.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's nice to go, thank you very much. And I always struggle with that, with sort of, I just say, thank you, I appreciate that. You know, it's nice that you say that. But don't start believing your own hype.
No.
Because that's when you just become a dickhead, basically. You know, it's nice to know that you've got the skills. And if you've got the skills, I think it's better when fellow magicians in your field say something nice about it. Then you've got like validation, if you like. But lay people don't believe you're good enough to go on Britain's Got Talent just because somebody's seen you do a double lift in a pub somewhere and they've never seen a magician do that before, because that's not going to win you on Britain's Got Talent. You're setting yourself up for a fall. Mm. You know, you have to know. I'm really passionate about that. You know, it's like, I know you've spoken about BGT, for example. You know, would you wouldn't go on BGT because it doesn't fit you. I wouldn't go on BGT for me. I'm old, fat, and can't be asked to slim down and be good looking. I'm beyond all that. And at the end of the day, that's what the world's like. It's a shallow industry. It's TV land, you know. And plus facts, I can't be doing with the stress that's involved. I mean, you've seen it with Ryland. You know, I mean, you've had to protect him from it.
Yeah, well, he had a great time. I've never been so stressed in my life. Everybody was messaging, going, oh, enjoy the experience. I'm like, Ryan is enjoying the experience. I'm about a fucking nerves.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And I've worked with quite a few people that have been on BGT over the years. And I've been sort of like on the end of the phone where they've gone, it's the semi-finals this time, and they've just lost all my props. So now I'm having to ring up Alexander, I'm having to send somebody out to a magic shop to pick him up. And I've practiced this routine for ages. Now they tell me I can't say these words and I can't use this particular prop because TV land don't like it, or it's not politically quite correct for the moment of time because something's happened. And the stress these people are under, you know, or they've been invited on Breakfast TV as a bounce back, but they've got nothing that works that way for telly, you know, and the amount of stress these guys, I mean, I have all the respect to these people like Dynamo and these guys that do TV magic where, you know, they've got to pick someone up, learn it, and then perform it an hour later and look like they've performed it a million years. That's a skill in itself. I could never do that in a million years. So I don't want to put myself under that pressure. Why would I want to?
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose the next question there is, why did I do Penn & Teller first?
Which is what? You must be psychic, because that's exactly what I was going to say. With all that in mind, why the hell did you put yourself through Penn & Teller? Now, I imagine, I've not done it myself, I imagine it's not as stressful from everyone. I've spoken to a lot of Penn & Teller contestants, Adam Wilbur, Sean Farquhar. I must have spoken to about 10 or 11 of them at this point. And they've all said how well-treated they were and how it was a wonderful experience and how the producers were really nice and Penn & Teller was really nice and it was a great, and nothing was too much trouble. So I imagine it's a different environment, but still, you know, in many ways, it's even more stressful. You're going out on national television in front of a live audience and in front of probably two of the greatest magicians of all time. Yeah. And definitely, you know, one of the most knowledgeable people in magic, and you're going out there, let's be clear, to try and fool the pants off them, and not just try and fool the pants off them, but you're going out there and being loud and proud to the point where you go, hi, my name's John Norton and I think I can fool you. You know, it's not, I imagine, like something that isn't stressful.
It's stressful. The run up to it is stressful in the fact that they'll make you change certain things. Script in particular was a big one for me. Like I say, I had to remake the book because of the artwork. That was a pain. That happened 3 weeks before I was due to do it. I mean, I got very lucky. My sort of into Foolers, I was very lucky in some ways. I'd already built something for Foolers that my icon was on Foolers. And didn't fool them, but the guy did a fantastic, Eric Samuels did a fantastic job with it. And he literally got it the night before because the time limit was so short to making it. I had to make it, literally work through the night for a week to get it made for him and then get it over to Vegas. It literally landed in his hotel room the night before he went on telly and did it. Luckily, obviously, the thing works self-working, so it's not too bad. But so that's where I was at with that. But so, yeah, they do mess around with the way with what your presentation is. The way that Fuller's works is you do an audition. Now, I kind of missed that bit out to a point. So I had a couple of friends, Matthew Pomeroy and Natasha Lamb, who are amazing illusionists, and they live magic and they travel around the world on cruise ships and doing different shows. I think they're on Broadway at the moment. They've done Vegas. They're on Broadway at the moment in New York. They've done the top cruise ships. They've done everything. But not many people know about them because they keep themselves to themselves. But I built a few props for them in the past. And they're good friends. And they did Fuller's that season. And they'd arranged the theatre because it was obviously all that to be done because of lockdown. It was all, nobody could travel, essentially. So they were organising the theatre for the English people to do their bit of filming for the show. And essentially they needed one more act. And they knew that I wanted to do the baby book on Fuller's because I'd offered it to loads of people. Nobody wanted to do it because it's just a kid's book. But I was quietly confident the baby book would fool them because it fooled everybody that had seen it, including some really big names, some like world FISM type people. 4F convention was taken to 4F convention by somebody and it floored everybody at 4F. So I was quietly confident I'd stand a chance with that. So I always said if ever I was going to do Foolers, I'd do it with the baby book just to see if it would generally fool them as well. So they put me in touch with the producers. I had to do a quick filming of what it would be, sent them an info, and then they basically WhatsApp you, Andrew and Lincoln. And then, so they WhatsApp me. I showed them the routine. They loved it. And then I have to tell them the method. So I told them the method and they burst out laughing because they realized how quick it's. So I actually taught it to them in less than 30 seconds so they could do it themselves. So then they were like, you're in. That's definitely going to be brilliant. And then it just went from, that was it. That's the routine I'm going to do. So, right, okay, now you're going to do it. We need it to be 5 minutes long. You can't do this. There's not going to be any audience. So we haven't, because it's COVID. So you're not going to be in the theater. There's no audience. You've got to make it 5 minutes. You've got to flower it up to make it Fuller's worthy. All these different rules. Oh, and we want the script to be more American so it sounds more like us. Bear in mind, I'm an English speaker, as you can tell I don't speak. It's funny because they introduced me, magic spoken in the Queen's English. I'm barely speaking English now. So it's quite funny when they did that. And the interesting thing, they put subtitles, so I obviously don't speak that well, do I? So I had to do all that before Fuller's. And then when it came to the actual night of filming, I'm sat here in my workshop and I'm supposed to go on at 7 o'clock, I think it was 7 or 7:30. Live streamed into their studio. You don't get to meet them or anything like that. We literally live streamed in, and I'm in the virtual green room, as it were. And they come on and go, we've got a problem with the last act. We're gonna have to do something. We'll get back. We'll just stay online. We'll be there. 10:30. I finally got the call that we were going to go straight out, and they'd also had me upload some different software onto my computer that at the time I had no idea about, and we didn't use in the end. So my mind was fried by 10:30. I had no idea what the script was, couldn't remember a thing. I knew how the book worked, luckily, but that was about it. So they were basically like, okay, you're going on now in 3, 2, 1, good luck. And all of a sudden, boom, I'm in the screen on this thing. And I'm like, and I just winged it. Because I knew the routine inside out, the routine I did on Fuller's was the routine I'd done a million times beforehand. And I didn't stick to their scripts. And there was a couple of bits in it that were purposely scripted for it that I did remember to do, but the rest of it was pretty much my normal routine. But because I knew what I'd been working this for a while, I knew it was pretty sound, and they just stick with it. And then obviously it fooled them, which was great. So yeah, that's pretty much where the Fuller's thing came about, really. But it wasn't about being publicly famous. It was about seeing whether or not the book would fool them. That's what it was about. Just to validate the book, really, to see if the method was sound.
So would you give, what advice would you give somebody who's, you know, fancies themselves going on Fuller's?
if you're going to go and fool us, make sure it's a trick you've done a million billion times. They often like something that's unique they haven't seen before. Try not to make it a card trick, because they get a million card tricks submitted all the time. They want something unique and different, something that no one's ever seen before. I showed you something earlier that no one's ever seen before. That's a prime example. To give you another idea, this is an idea I had. We're not going to do this on Foolers, so I'll tell you what it is. So it doesn't. I don't know if they watch the show, but if they do, well, then they'll this won't bust them. I had the idea, Luca Volpe. I worked with Luca on the last season. Luca was on it, and I worked with him on his act to get him on it, and it was me that put him forward for it. And he didn't fool them, but he still had a great time. He's like, I want to go back. I want to do it again. But we don't know what to do it with. But he wants to go on with me. And I'm like, well, actually, I've got a routine for that. I just don't know whether to do it or not. And we've decided we're not going to do it. So I can tell you what the routine is. The idea was, Luca was going to walk on stage, go, hi, Luca here. Didn't fool you last time, but I've got some backup this time. Somebody that did fool you. Please welcome John Morton. And I'd pop up on the screen again, still in my workshop here. Right, so he's managed to get to Vegas. I'm still in England. And he goes, we're going to do a card trick, but it's a bit different. And he gets a pack of cards out. He goes, John, you're there. And I'm there, like, can't hear you. You're on mute. He's like, one sec. He goes off to the stage, comes out with carrying a big pipe. Right, and he goes, and I go, one sec. And I come off stage, bring up, hold up my pipe and put it to my ear. And he talks down the pipe at me. And now we can talk, right? And he goes, what? So I'm like, do the trick. He's like, okay, I'll do the trick. So this is how silly it is. He gets a pack of cards. He gets them to pick a card, free choice. They pick any card they want. And they sign it and they draw pictures on it, do whatever they want with it. We show it to the camera really clearly so everyone can see it's uniquely their card. He folds it into quarters. And out the tube, there's a piece of string with a bulldog clip on it. He clips the card to the bulldog clip, goes like that to me, and I start pulling the string at my end, and the thing goes boom, into the tube. And I'm pulling, loads of string coming out of it. And eventually, boom, out comes a card at my end in England. And I open up the card and show it to it's their card. So what's the method?
That's incredible.
Yeah. So what's the method? Come on, be Penn and Teller. See if you can get it.
Obviously, you can't put a card from America to England. That's just ridiculous. So the only way to do it would be to force a card and somehow duplicate a signature.
And that's exactly what I'd want them to think, which is not the method. The method is the workshop that I'm behind, that they saw me in 2 years ago, is completely fake. And I'm actually in Vegas on the other end of the tube, genuinely pulling the string through and bringing out to you their actual physical card. Because it's so ridiculous.
Why are you not going on and doing that? Because it would fool them, and I want to see their face. And you walk out, and you're just like, "Fuck you!"
Yeah, yeah. We did toy with it. It was funny. It was just a funny idea. It originated from the idea. Original idea came from I wanted to do something with, you know, the two cans of string you had as a kid. Two cans with a piece of string, and you talk to it, and you can hear it. I thought, would it be great to do a trick like that? You can do a mobile phone trick, but you're going to do it old school and you bring out these cans and a string. And then I had this idea that somebody would get a card folded, put it in the can, and somehow it would come out the other can. But obviously you can't do that. And then I was talking to Kieran Johnston about it, saying, you know, they've got this idea, but can't cut. And Kieran went, make it a tube and just generally pull it through the tube. I'm like, that's genius. The guy's a genius. So with his input, again, this is what I mean about having people that you trust to brainstorm with. It came up into that routine of me being, because I like the idea of me being in the studio, but them not knowing it and the background, because it's a bit like Max Mellini, where he'd set a trick up 2 or 3 years in advance by having a card sewn into somebody's lining of their jacket. They've seen my workshop 2 years ago. We were going to set up exactly the same, but it would be fake. So it'd be a fake workshop rather than a duplicate card. You know, that's the mindset you've got to have. When you think about it, it's a stupid, unique kind of trick. Nobody's thought about transporting a card from one place to a different country. So that's the sort of thing the TV company want. It's not really a card trick, it's a transposition. But it's so outlandishly stupid that it's the sort of thing the producers would lap up. So if you want to go and fool us, have something like that that seems like, oh, it could be this method, this method, this method, and the method's actually over here, then you've got a really good chance of doing well on foolers. And even if you don't fool them, don't worry about it, because it's not about fooling them. It's just about having fun and just seeing if you're good enough to do it, you know, and just have a laugh with it. Don't take it serious, you know. At the end of the day, I did foolers. It's not really got me that much extra work, if I'm honest. Yes, it made me a bit bigger name in the magic community. So more people started to take notice. Oh, what else has he created? But gig-wise, it's given bragging rights to the people that have booked me for weddings and stuff. Oh, my guys, you know, Fool Penn and Teller, whatever. But that's about it. Nobody's ringing me up to go, oh, you Fool Penn and Teller, I want to book you for this, you know, corporate gig or whatever. That's not happened. If you want to do that, I want to be famous publicly, go on BGT and do something on BGT. But if you're going to do BGT, it has to be world class. Where the magic tricks used to be here, they're here now on BGT. Oh. I mean, Russ has just took that beyond the next level stuff, you know. And the Rylands Act, I still maintain Rylands Act was one of the best acts I saw at Blackpool this last year, because it's the choreography of it with all the kids coming out, and the moment he goes stop and they all do that, just breathtaking, really breathtaking, you know. And that's what it needs to be at that level if you're going to do that sort of thing for BGT. Don't just go out there with an ambitious card routine. And you know that the Asian guy that did it this year, his act was brilliant. It was just street magic, but he didn't win on the magic, he won on his personality. His personality was infectious. The guy was just so funny.
Yeah,
you know, he could have been doing anything with that personality, and he still would have done as well as he did.
Yeah,
you know, but if you're going on there and you're going on for magic, you need to think: am I a TV type people, somebody that the person likes? Because if you're young, good looking, slim, and you look like you've got a future, Simon Cowell's going to be much more interested in you than if you're Subo. You know, if you are Subo, your trick needs to be three times better than the good looking guy to get through. You know. Really does. It's just a fact of life. Don't take it personally, because it's not a personal thing. It's just TV land. It really is. You know, that's totally my thoughts and all that sort of stuff. It really is.
That's really good advice. Really, really, really good advice. This has been an amazing interview. This has been a masterclass. I'm going to ask you one last question. Final question. What's next? Because you've achieved, and I say this to a lot of people that come on the channel, and I know that you listen to the interviews, so I know that you probably know this, but it's so pertinent to you. Like, you've had such a great career, you know, considering you started as a jeweler and you got into magic quite late. If you don't take what, you know, you got into magic quite late, and yet look at how much you've actually achieved. You're Fool Penn and Teller. You've created magic for some huge names. You've released some of the most popular magic tricks of all time. You've got an incredible name as a creator of magic. You perform all of the time. Like everything that I said at the beginning of the interview, where you were like, wow, I was expecting a different person. That's you. And that's what you've done. And sometimes I think we forget how much we've achieved. And what you've done is just brilliant. I mean, you could rest on your laurels and nobody would like say anything because of how much you've done. But I know from speaking to you that you've probably got more plans. Although you don't seem to like plan, it just happens to you. I don't know what it is. It's just like you achieve all of this success. I don't know if there's a big master plan or anything, or if it just kind of, you know, it's that old thing, isn't it? You put good stuff out into the world and good things will happen to you. You seem to embody that. So,
yeah.
What's the plan moving forward? You know, do you have any goals that you want to hit on your magical bucket list?
I've ticked off quite a few of them already. The foolish thing was a bucket list thing. That was good. The joining the magic circle, that was a massive bucket list for me. That was the 7-year-old me with that little Paul Daniels magic set and that scrapbook, seeing the magic circle was just this mysterious place. When I first got into that and I went straight in as AMIC, I was extremely proud. I think the magic circle's an amazing place. And I think it's a very creative place. So that was a big bucket list tick. Doing the lecture there recently, that was a bucket list tick. I do have a few other ones on my goal. I'd love to do a lecture at Blackpool. That's purely from again, going to Blackpool 7 years, seeing other people do it, I just want to see if I've got the balls to do it. And to test myself out, really, I suppose, with that. I have a trick at the moment that's ticking away in the back of my mind. I know what it's going to do. I know how to do it. And it's never been done before. It's more of a reveal than it is a routine. But the routine, the reveal is so spectacular. If I get it and it works like I want it to, and like I can see it in my head, I might start doing a competition piece with that. Wow. And I've even, if it works as good as I think it will be, it might be something I'd be tempted to try and head towards FISM with. Purely, again, because I just want to see if it would be good enough for it. But it just depends whether or not I can get to that level. Because I'm not skillful like a lot of these guys that go on to FISM. You know, I'm not dexterous with my cards. My fingers don't move as well as they used to anymore. I've got short, stumpy little fingers. I've not got piano player fingers, you know. But I might be able to create my way into something on that. So, yeah, I've got an idea. I'll tell you off camera what that is if you like. I've not shared it with anybody. So, yeah, that's potentially where I'm. Short of that, I've got a plan that in the next 4 years, I'm going to slowly wind down the performance side slightly to the point. I mean, I'm already working pretty much purely on word of mouth. For every gig I do, I get one gig back off it. And it's, so it's rolling now. Pandemic was very bad for my website. The server that I was using went down completely kaput. So it moved to a new one and changed the IP address. So I went from being 15 years as number one in my area to nowhere now. I'm like five pages down. And I'm not smart enough on SEO to get it back up again. And to be honest, the work's still coming in anyway. Not that's just everybody does this and just rest on your laurels. For God's sake, don't do that, especially if you're trying to make a name for yourself. But I see myself for another 3-4 years of gigging, and then I'll perform when I want to. If I can keep the prop building side going, that's where the mile is. So this will be my life in my little home from home, my little workshop here, with all my little knickknacks and stuff around me. And I will just continue making other people look good. That's what I'd love to do. I'd like to work with people who want to be successful, that are generally nice, that they're not just out of it because they want to be famous. Somebody that's a nice guy that deserves a good break. Like Ryland and like the kids of the Magic Circle, those guys are our future.
Yeah, they
you
are.
Know, and it's so good to see such a mix of boys and girls in there. And I'd like to help people like that be successful. So if I can add any of my wacky things to it that helps them on their way, well, you know, that's enough for me. I say it on Foolers, and I don't think many people believe me, but I have no interest in being famous. If I can see somebody else performing my trick and they're doing really well, that's enough of a buzz for me, is to see somebody else do well off it using that thing. Icon's performed around the world by people. It's touring at the moment with Jamie Raven. Icon ESP is touring on the same show with James and Dylan. You know, when I see that, that gives me a buzz. Those guys are brilliant. These are much better performers than I am. And yet, yeah, they're using something that's come out of this little workshop here in Grimsby. That's where I want to be. You know, I'm happy to be behind the scenes. I'd much rather be behind the scenes than have all that stress of being in front of the camera. Having said that, I do a little show that works that I do every month in the little tea room. It's about 16 to 25 people. People pay £30 a head. They come in, they get a two-course meal and a drink. I do close-up magic, and then 9 o'clock, I do a 90-minute show, which is a stage show. And I do that pure. I don't make any money on it, hardly. It's a complete massive loss of money, but I do it just for the joy of it, you know, and it gets the tea room some exposure, which is great. But that's just for the fun of it. But the nice thing with that is it's given me the stage time to get things wrong and to improve every time. So every time I do a show, I sit down with a list of what worked, what didn't work. I have good, bad and ugly, basically, columns. And then the ugly column gets replaced or worked on completely. But the good gets definitely worked on, and the great sort of stays there. And that's just, everybody does that with every, if you're starting out and you're performing, whether it be stage or close up, when you get home that night, do your three columns, good, bad and ugly. ugly stuff, change it for something else, unless it's just a case of you had a bad day. Good stuff, work on, get it better, improve the script, and the really good stuff, keep that in your act. That's going to be your A-list. It really is.
That's cool. That's so cool. That's so cool. That's really cool. Man, I say this almost every time I do an interview, but this has been one of my favorite interviews. It really has. Like, you are genuinely such a nice guy, and I know from knowing you that you will help anybody, and the community is in a better place because of you. So thank you so much, and I hope that you continue to inspire people to be as nice as you are and as creative and as talented as you are, because John, you're absolutely amazing.
Thank you, mate, appreciate it, I really do.
If people want to reach out to you, like maybe they want to get something or they want to speak to you about having something built, where can people reach out to you?
So custommagic.co.uk is my prop building site. You can't buy anything on it. It's literally like a showroom site, although there is an instruction page on there once you've got the actual trick. If you go on there, look at something, and you like it, shoot me a message. The best way to get hold of me, there is an inquiry form on it, but your best thing to do if you want me to answer quickly is shoot me a message on Facebook, because that's usually what pops up first before anything else. If you do want something off me and it's not something that I have in stock, for instance, I usually have baby books and something supers, big blinds, twins, they're normally in stock. But if it's something like an icon, that might take me a month to make, or an icon ESP. Again, I've always got a 4-month waiting list normally of people wanting things. So I try and fit little jobs in the middle, but don't ring me up a week before you go on BGT and expect me to build something, because it won't happen. Because I don't like letting people down. What I'll usually tell you to do is remind me in a month's time or something, because again, I'll forget. My memory's shocking. I do try to make notes of things, but don't. So you can get me on that. Short of that, if you Google me, I pop up everywhere. I'm dead easy to find. I've got no chance of ever escaping. So, I'm probably one of the easiest ones to find. You can find my phone number on there. You can find my mobile. I don't mind. I love talking to people, love talking to magicians. I'm always happy to help as much as I can. And like I say, as long as you're a nice guy, don't be a knob. That should be the headline of the thing. Don't be a knob.
Make that the headline. That's amazing. So reach out to John. Make sure you do reach out to him, because he's got some incredible stuff. And do you have a mailing list? You have a mailing list, don't you?
You know, I don't even have that. I don't want to jam people up with loads of stuff. If they want to see something, I'll probably put it on Custom Magic, or you'll just hear about it. I really need to go on your course for business, don't I? Because I'm terrible at this sort of stuff.
You're like the magical equivalent of the A-team, if you can find him.
Yeah,
and maybe you can hire John Morton.
Yes. Yeah. I love solving problems. If you've got a problem, come and find me.
There you go. The best kept secret in magic. And despite how hard he works, more people find out about him. That's amazing. Okay, awesome. So drop him a message on Facebook. Check out his website. And more importantly, leave a comment down below. Let John know what you thought of the interview. Let him know if you've got one of his products. Let him know down below. If you saw him on Penn & Teller Fool Us, let him know in the comments down below. And I'm going to be back next Saturday with another Talk Magic. But John, one more time, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Keep up the good work.
Will do, mate. Thanks very much. Guys, we'll see you again soon. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.